supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. In November, then-President-elect Donald Trump promised to bring back millions of jobs in shale energy and clean coal. Last month, he issued an executive order aimed at dismantling the Obama administration's Clean Power Plan, again referencing clean coal. Liz Reed of WESA in Pittsburgh takes a look at what clean coal is and whether it's likely to gain traction in Pennsylvania.
When Environmental Protection Agency head Scott Pruitt visited a Greene County coal mine last week, he echoed the president, saying, quote, "The war on coal is done."
We're going to improve the environment in this country, protect our water, protect our air, but at the same time, do it the American way. Grow jobs and show the rest of the world that we can achieve it.
It's almost infeasible.
That's Inez Azevedo, co-director of the Climate and Energy Decision-Making Center at Carnegie Mellon University. She says the term clean coal needs to be defined.
Clean coal could only be clean coal if you have very aggressive air control technologies implemented and addressing also the CO2 emissions by installing carbon capture and sequestration in parallel. But that's really hard.
Azevedo says it's hard because it's expensive, despite the fact that academics first began exploring carbon capture and sequestration technology in 1989, it was only in January that the nation's first clean coal power plant opened. Meanwhile, power generation in Pennsylvania continues to move away from coal and toward natural gas. Azevedo says that's due in part to federal regulations, but also to the fact that the price of natural gas is so low. Dave Geyer is spokesperson for NRG Energy, which owns several power plants in Pennsylvania, including a coal-powered plant northeast of Pittsburgh.
I think coal is going to be phased out over time. You're going to see certainly more natural gas, because natural gas plants are much more flexible. They can ramp up and down much more quickly. And that also helps ensure that we can integrate renewables.
Geyer says NRG is committed to increasing its investment in renewable energy, particularly wind and solar. The company's goal is to cut their emissions of CO2 and other greenhouse gases by 50% by 2030 and 90% by 2050. Coal's presence in powering Pennsylvania has been in sharp decline over the last decade and a half. In the year 2000, coal accounted for 58% of the electricity generated in the state. By 2015, that had dropped to 30%, largely due to the growth in the natural gas industry. Emissions have dropped as well. During that same time period, carbon intensity, which is the amount of CO2 per unit of energy generated, declined by nearly a third.
While it was very good news, it's very little in comparison to what we need to achieve if we want to achieve a deep decarbonization.
Azevedo says she worries that emissions might creep back up if the Trump administration finds the right mix of subsidies and reduced regulations to make coal a more attractive investment. First Energy owns the Beaver Valley Nuclear Generating Station northwest of Pittsburgh, as well as several natural gas plants in Pennsylvania. But across its six-state footprint, more than half of its electricity generation comes from coal. Here's spokesperson Stephanie Walton.
President Trump's executive order is an important first step, but while the action is positive, it'll take some time, I think, to understand the long-term impacts of that order.
While First Energy has sold or shuttered its coal-powered plants in Pennsylvania, that was due to the company's decision to exit the PA market altogether. Walton says they have no plans to phase out coal in other states. Dave Geyer of NRG and Inez Azevedo of CMU both say coal will continue to be a part of the mix for a while, in part because it helps keep the grid stable. But Azevedo says it simply cannot be the dominating fuel for electricity generation.
Otherwise, we're closing the window where we can achieve the emissions reductions that we need.
The Clean Power Plan had sought to reduce carbon emissions by 32% from 2005 levels by 2030. What the Trump administration's plan is for preserving both the coal industry and the environment remains to be seen. I'm Liz Reed in Pittsburgh.
Philadelphia is renowned as a city of diverse neighborhoods. Championing urban diversity was a cornerstone of Jane Jacobs' landmark 1961 book, The Death and Life of Great American Cities, that challenged urban planning norms of the time. That time and her story are depicted in the IFC documentary, Citizen Jane, Battle for the City. Let's learn more from the film's director, Matt Tiernauer. Matt, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Good to be here.
Jane was born in Scranton. Most of her work was done in New York, and she was also famously affiliated with Canada, Toronto specifically, though there is a section of this film devoted to Society Hill when she worked with Edmund Bacon, executive director of the Philadelphia City Planning Commission at the time.
That's right. She writes extensively about Philadelphia in her classic book. In fact, she also focuses on Rittenhouse Square and a few other neighborhoods. Philadelphia was one of the test cases for the urban renewal of the 50s and 60s in the country, and Edmund Bacon was at the forefront. And Jacobs said the light bulb really went off when Philadelphia Society Hill was built. It wasn't working the way the planners said it was going to be, and she had believed them when she saw the renderings of what they were doing. And when she saw that it was a dysfunctional place, even though it was brand new, she kind of said, wait a minute, there's not the emperors have no clothes. Urban renewal is not working.
Of course, the primary emperor with whom she tried to strip away the clothes was one Robert Moses in New York. And it's amazing in retrospect to realize that both the power he had and his ability to advance his idea, which was essentially kind of like that of a surgeon, identify a cancer and then cut it out.
Yes, these medical metaphors were frequently applied. Moses saw blighted neighborhoods as urban cancer. He referred to them literally as that. He referred to East Harlem, which at the time had not been obliterated in large part for public housing projects, as a cancerous area that needed to be carved out. I mean, we're talking about scores of city blocks of what we would consider today to be the most exquisite brownstone housing like that you'd find in areas of Philadelphia still around Rittenhouse Square and some around Society Hill, that if they were still there today would be cherished. At the time, this urban cancer was excised. What Jacobs was saying is, how about trying some urban acupuncture instead of this radical surgery?
Was it in part that she was underestimated because she didn't have the cred in terms of being an architect or an urban planner or well-connected? Because she was dismissed, was that paradoxically how she was able to infiltrate in part and get her ideas spread and recognized?
She did have the advantage of an outsider, which is not traditionally seen as an advantage. Another factor that contributed to her being an outsider was the fact that she was a woman. Architecture and planning are still male-dominated fields. She was not credentialed. She didn't have a college diploma. She was a journalist and a very accomplished one who covered, it so happened, the urban renewal period.
And it wasn't a matter of tweaking or evolving. She found it to be 180 degrees wrong. Prior to her coming to the fore, it was top-down. She advocated bottom-up.
Yeah, and incremental. The thing about urban planning, look, you can't just leave everything the way it is. She never said that. She was for change, but intelligent change. And the urban renewalists were clean slate. So they wanted to tear down all these neighborhoods and replace them with new building.
Matt, certainly you envisioned and executed this film prior to the current administration, but viewers watching it now in 2017 probably can't help but wonder in part about, say, implications regarding potential housing and urban development funding cuts.
Cuts, and also the term urban renewal, which is a pejorative term now. When it started in the 50s, it was a positive term, but the outcome was so terrible that it's now negative. But the term urban renewal is bandied about by the current administration. I think that the so-called the infrastructure plans that are being talked about now seem like great things on the surface. But what Jane Jacobs points out, and I think part of the lesson of this movie, is that collusive planning, meaning big money colluding with government, often leaves the little guy out of the equation. So you have to really keep your eye on that. Yes, we need infrastructure. It's been delayed shamefully in this country, which has a lot to do with political gridlock. But I think we have to watch out and make sure that whatever infrastructure and whatever so-called urban renewal, I don't know what that means in this context anymore, happens, that big money and developers aren't the winners at the expense of either low-income people or anybody that wants to live in a city.
Matt Tiernauer, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
My pleasure.
Citizen Jane, Battle for the City opens in select cities today, and then in Philadelphia May 5th. You can hear more of our conversation at newsworks.org. A Delaware mother's concern for her visually impaired son has led to new training for members of the Wilmington Police Department. Details from WHYY's Mark Eichmann.
15-year-old Bryant Harper can only see about 5 feet in front of him, yet he's able to successfully maneuver around Wilmington, walking to the bus stop to get to and from work. But because of his disability, Bryant can be a target of thieves. That's one worry his mother, Jemira Carmona, has for him. Another concern? What would happen if Bryant were to be stopped by the police?
You can't tell he's visually impaired. So my fear was that he wears a hat to shield from the sun, and sunglasses don't help him. So if he's being approached by an officer and he doesn't respond how they expect him to, he could be hurt because he is being defiant to one that doesn't know.
In hopes of avoiding that type of confrontation, Carmona reached out to the Delaware Division for the Visually Impaired for help. That meeting resulted in training sessions for more than 100 Wilmington police officers. Teachers like Heather Daugherty showed officers how they can help Bryant and others like him.
You know, if I were to approach Bryant from the side, he may not see me. He might respond a little bit differently than somebody else. And that's what potentially could, you know, cause a different reaction either from whoever or from Bryant.
After the classroom training, officers also got to experience a little bit of what it's like to lose their sight. They donned blindfolds and, with some assistance from colleagues, walked a busy downtown Wilmington street without being able to see.
Watch the curb to your right. Careful.
Keep going. Stop.
Wilmington Police Sergeant Andrea Janvier says 120 members of the patrol division have taken the training.
Any key indicator that we can process from this learning, from this training today, to have our first responding, our frontline patrol division officers recognize a symbol of blindness or a symbol of some type of impairment. Absolutely, it's a win for us.
The Division for the Visually Impaired's Maria Lepore Stevens says the training is designed to ensure officers think about whether someone's unseen disability may be influencing the way they react to the police.
It's really scary as a person with a visual impairment if you're walking along and someone grabs you, or they grab your cane, or they touch your dog, or they come into your vision when you didn't know that they were there at all. And for these officers to understand, well, like, let's take a step back. If this person isn't responding, why, I think, do they have a visual impairment? Do they have some sort of disability? Do they have hearing loss?
Bryant says he's happy to share his story to help officers understand.
Well, I like to tell my story a lot, and I like to let people know, how can they help me, or how can I let them know what to do when I need helping.
For his mother, training the police helps, but she says everyone can do their part to help those with disabilities.
Just be kind to people. Be kind. And if someone does ask for help, just help. Just help out.
From the Delaware Desk, I'm Mark Eichmann, WHYY News.
You can see the officer's training in action, as well as other stories from Delaware, on First, tonight at 11 on WHYY-TV. Donald Trump is fast approaching the completion of 100 days in office. Let's learn how the public grades the president on a scale of 1 to 100 with Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup poll. Hi, Frank.
Hello, Dave.
Well, I suspect the president would give himself high marks. He said this week that, quote, no administration has accomplished more in the first 90 days. Does the public agree?
Well, it depends on how you look at the data, but I would say no. One way that we have of measuring presidents in the context of other presidents is our classic approval rating. And his have fluctuated some, as low as 35% after the health care bill did not get passed in the House, of course. That effort failed. It's been up a little higher. Actually, right now at the end of this week, it's at 43%. But if we want to average out his first quarter in office, which would go through April 20th, his approval rating has been 41%. Context, that's the lowest for the first quarter of any president we have, and that goes back to Dwight Eisenhower when he first took office. The next lowest first quarter in office was Bill Clinton, which would have been back in 1993 at 55%. The highest, you'll want to know, John Kennedy, who had a 74% job approval rating in his first quarter in office, which would have been back in 1961.
Would you consider that Bill Clinton rating of 55% the first breach whereby partisanship became more and more the rule?
Yes, and that's an excellent point. One of the reasons that Donald Trump is not doing well is that he gets almost no approval from Democrats. In fact, over the last 3 months, 9% is the number. His approval rating among his own party, Republicans, is up in the 80% range, and that's actually about where other presidents have been recently. So what's really hurting Donald Trump is that 9% among Democrats. And then if you look over time, you see that presidents' approval ratings in their first quarter among people who identify with the opposing party have been going down, down, down. And that's germane to your comment about Bill Clinton. He still did better. His approval rating was about 30% among the opposing party, which would have been Republicans, when in his first quarter in office. But the Bushes, particularly George W. Bush, had lower ratings, and Obama had a lower rating among the opposing party, which for Obama would have been Republicans, and now Trump's even lower. And I think it would have been Hillary Clinton's problem. Had she been elected, she would have been getting very low ratings among Republicans. In a polarized environment today, it's hard to get high approval ratings because you've got to bring over some people from the other side, and that's very hard to do.
Across political parties, I believe one can still say that Americans rally round the flag, and with foreign affairs very much in the news the past week or so, have we seen an uptick in the president's ratings?
We didn't see an immediate one after he ordered the missiles launched from destroyers in the Mediterranean at the Syrian airfield. Now, this week right now, 43% is his approval rating, so it's up a couple of points. But we did not see a classic rally effect, which occurs sometimes when something happens internationally, and in the short term, the president's approval rating goes up.
Frank, let's next take up notions around capital punishment, particularly with Arkansas very much in the news.
There are some polls in Arkansas that show that clearly a majority of residents in that state approve of the death penalty, anywhere from 60 to 70%, depending on what poll you look at. Nationally, 60%, 6-0, that's about the percent of Americans who favor the death penalty in cases of murder in the U.S. That's down some from where it has been, but clearly, and this is surprising to some people when I talk about this, a clear majority of Americans to this day still favor the death penalty.
Does Gallup take a closer look and probe why those who support it do so?
Oh, indeed we do, and it's biblical. An eye for an eye, that comes out of the Bible. It's vengeance. Actually, when we probe Americans and we say, is this a deterrent, the death penalty deterrent, and they say, no, we really don't think it's a deterrent because that's one of the arguments. We also say, well, what about innocent people who can be convicted and then given the death penalty and later DNA evidence or something shows that they're innocent? And Americans say, yes, we recognize that occasionally that will happen. And yet with those thoughts in mind, we still have a majority of Americans who support the death penalty. And again, based on our data, it comes back to a feeling, an emotional feeling, it looks like to us on the part of a lot of Americans, that somebody who kills somebody else, particularly in a heinous type crime, deserves to die themselves.
Thanks, Frank.
You bet, Dave.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight. This weekend, an extension of the Schuylkill River Trail will open in southwest Philadelphia. Bartram's Mile passes through industrial zones and open meadows along the riverbank with a view of the city skyline. WHYY's Peter Crimmins tried out the new trail on his bicycle.
We're starting at the southern tip, the southern end of the Bartram Trail. This is the plaza. This used to be overgrown and full of trash. No one ever came here and saw this view. This view only came to be because they built this plaza. It's not bad. It's nice. Bartram Mile is the latest edition of the Schuylkill River Trail. It extends from Grace Ferry Bridge, the Grace Ferry Crescent, down past Bartram's Garden to this southern point. Eventually it'll go further south, but for right now this is what they did. We're going uphill a little bit to enter into Bartram's Garden proper. The director of this garden, Maitreya Roy, told me that she wants to leverage this trail to better connect the residents of southwest Philadelphia to Center City and to connect them to the Bartram's Garden and the river.
56th Street now in some ways is going to be a new community connector. We're really excited about the fact that not only does the trail reveal a whole new section of the riverfront, it also reaches right back to the community and draws people in.
This new segment of the river trail, 1 mile long, costs $6.7 million coming from public and private funding sources. And right now, it's still an orphan trail. It's not yet connected to the very popular Schuylkill River Trail that runs through Center City. The director of the city's Department of Parks and Recreation, Catherine Ott Lovell, says river trails improve the neighborhoods they run through.
We certainly can't deny the economic development of Center City, but it will be wonderful to see what this trail can mean in terms of community and economic development for Southwest Philadelphia. And I think that will be the long-term return on the investment that we've made in seeing this trail through to its completion.
The next phase of the trail development is to connect Bartram's Mile with Gray's Ferry Crescent Park, which means hopping the river. The city has already acquired an abandoned railroad bridge that will bring the trails together. I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. At the helm this week, Al Banks, Diana Martinez, and Adam Staniszewski. Sandra Clark is Vice President of News and Civic Dialogue. John Musoni is Assistant Vice President for News Operations, and our News Director is Eugene Son. Thanks for joining us and have a great weekend. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.